is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics to champion your legal rights so that you can obtain equal access and full participation in our community, and so that we can achieve goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies, as well as nonprofit organizations and our courts. We'll promote information on law supporting independent living. In today's episode, our guest is Whitney Hosey. Whitney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Joe. Appreciate it.
We're glad to have you. Whitney is an associate with Naren Wenzel, PA, a law firm that has offices in Smithfield and Raleigh, and is one of the sponsors from time to time of our show. Whitney, thank you very much for joining us, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, thank you very much again for having me, Joe. I appreciate it. And I am a recent law school grad from Wake Forest University School of Law, graduated in 2019, passed the bar, came to work for Naren Wenzel this past September. Very excited and very lucky to be there. I graduated from the University of Virginia with a BA in History and Government in 2014. Went to work in New York for a couple of years for some advertising agencies up there. So very familiar with the topic that we're going to be discussing today in the advertising world. But I'm interested to see more of the legal world of these things as well. And so in my time at Wake Forest, I specialized in real estate, estate planning, and intellectual property law, specifically with communications law is my focus and privacy law. And then at Wake Forest as well, I served as the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Business and Intellectual Property Law, which is a legal journal that focuses specifically on intellectual property law and business law and the intersection between the two. So the topic we're getting ready to talk about today is pretty true to my nature.
And so glad to have you, since I'm a refugee from the Gutenberg galaxy. And we're glad to have somebody who is conversational and cognizant of the 21st century issues that we'll be dealing with today. But so Domino's Pizza delivers.
It does.
That's the jingle. And so we're talking today about the case of Robles versus Domino's Pizza out of California. Now, what in the world does that have to do with the North Carolina Reading Service and our listeners?
Sure. Well, it actually has quite a lot to do with it. So the case comes out of the Ninth Circuit, which is a federal circuit court out of California, a few other states over there on the West Coast as well. And so the roles of the federal courts are basically to help develop laws, which can not only be relied upon sort of nationally in some circumstances, they can also give people an indication of where the law might be headed, particularly as influential as the circuit is in the Ninth Circuit. So in Robles, just a quick background of the facts here. So Mr. Robles was trying to order pizza off the Domino's mobile app, and unfortunately, due to his impairment, was unable to do so. And he had tried repeatedly. So inevitably, he ends up suing Domino's under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which, as we know, under Title III of that act, requires websites, retail places, and certain other categories of stores, places of public accommodation under the act, to be compliant with requirements under the act. So one of the requirements is to provide access to websites and other such things like mobile apps, just as someone with a non-disability would be able to. So Mr. Robles, having some issues with this mobile app, then proceeds to sue. And the holding in the case essentially came down to that Domino's was responsible, even on its website and mobile apps, for providing access to its physical store. So because the app and the website gave certain promotions that were being offered in stores, it gave location services for the local store to review, it gave delivery preferences and such things, they were forced to then sort of comply with ADA. This is a relatively new decision coming out of these courts, and so we're starting to see different circuits throughout the United States addressing this role. We were talking sort of before the program here about in 2018 alone, there were over 2,200 cases that have been filed about this particular issue. And so one of the things that we're starting to see as technology develops, right, how does the ADA, which was written back in 1990 and has had several updates since then, but very few regarding websites specifically, how is it going to keep up as well? So that's pretty much where the case came down, was that as websites start to develop, there is some ADA level of compliance. Now, the Ninth Circuit is not a nationally recognized court. It's not the Supreme Court of the United States. So not every jurisdiction has to comply with this, but it will be interesting to see how other courts start to come down on these decisions in the future.
Indubitably. Whitney, I told you before we came on air that I've been doing this program for 4 years. And not to put any pressure on you, but I think this is the most important program we've ever done here. And this issue, and really it's interesting because it's not something that the United States Supreme Court has done, but it's something that they didn't do in this case. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. In fact, the parties in this particular case appealed. So Domino's, having technically, quote-unquote, lost the case, appealed and asked for certiorari in the Supreme Court, which refused to take on the case. So in other words, it may have been as a result of being too busy. It may have been a result as letting the individual circuits decide until they kind of get a better idea of what's going on. But the Supreme Court declined to overturn the case. So it's interesting to see that they didn't take a particularly strong stance against the decision that was made in this case.
So I go back to that jingle, Domino's Pizza Delivers. And so this comes out of Mr. Robles trying to order a pizza using the app and website for Domino's and not being able to do it. And so he sues, and as I understand the procedural history of this case, the district court dismissed it out of hand without giving Mr. Robles an opportunity to do discovery and to get the evidence out on the table, so to speak. It was a summary dismissal a 12B6 dismissal, and so it goes up to the Ninth Circuit. What was Mr. Robles using to try to access and unsuccessfully? Does the case tell us anything about that?
Yeah, so Mr. Robles had screen reading software, software that's specifically designed, as most of your readers probably already know, that's designed to interact with websites to help facilitate the disabled individual to be able to use that website just like a non-disabled person would be able to. So the screen reading software, based on my understanding of the case, and there's very limited facts in here available to us other than the screen reading software, so I don't know the specific brand or the specific type, but my understanding is that the screen reading software was unable to properly facilitate the ordering of specific ingredients and specific things. So we're still dealing with technology that's, to be perfectly frank, somewhat outdated, because as websites and different mobile apps continue to progress, the screen reading software I don't necessarily know is being updated as quickly as possible to be able to facilitate those same changes. So I think inevitably we're going to see that over the next few years, particularly with, you know, interactive websites with virtual reality things like the Oculus glasses that simulate sort of virtual reality interactions with video games and things like that. It'll be interesting to see exactly how ADA continues to kind of keep up with those changes, given the screen reading software that we have available to us today.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, just give you some background. I mean, over the past 4 years, from time to time, we talk about the ADA Title I, which has to do with employment, ADA Title II, which has to do with access to public institutions, and then ADA Title III, which has to do with access to public accommodations including businesses like Domino's. So interesting, we're talking here about a commodity good, pizzas, and we're talking about delivery, which has become de rigueur these days. Very seldom. I don't even know if Domino's has restaurants that you can walk into. A lot of places these days are just departure points for the goods, Domino's being one of them. But what sort does the case talk about? Guidelines and regulations that are either in the works or have been discussed?
It does. So there's an interesting discussion within the case about whether or not the Department of Justice, who inevitably is the one that enforces and basically is in charge of the legislation in dealing with Title III specifically. And so occasionally what we'll get is guidelines from Department of Justice in terms of website compatibility. Now, that being said, there are globally recognized visually impaired websites that provide some technological or technical programming. I don't know, the word basically would be programming entities that would say, you know, here's what a compliant website would look like. Now, those are not recognized in the United States as being required, but they are highly encouraged, particularly for businesses that do business globally. The DOJ will release certain technical requests or certain technical requirements that websites can choose to comply with. In this particular instance, and one of the things that Domino's heavily relies on, is that DOJ over the past couple of years has been reluctant to release certain requirements. And DOJ's justification for that is so that they can remain flexible. And I think part of the reason why they're trying to remain as flexible as possible is because of the developing nature of technology, right? Because if DOJ comes down and says you have to have these certain requirements, and then 2 months from now those requirements are outdated, DOJ would spend 90% of its time trying to keep those requirements updated. So thankfully, and I think rightfully so, the court basically says just because DOJ doesn't set down specific guidelines doesn't mean you don't have to comply with the ADA. DOJ has been very clear that websites do fall under Title III, but just because they don't have specific technical applications doesn't necessarily mean that compliance is not required. So I think DOJ's decision not to set down specific requirements for these websites is actually probably the smarter thing to do given the developing nature of technology in these days. So that's not something I think the defendants will be able to rely on in the future. I think most courts at this point would probably adopt that stance. DOJ has been very clear compliance is required. How that compliance is met is sort of being left up to the individual websites themselves.
We've actually had a couple of programs in the past, talking about the Department of Justice, DOJ being the enforcement arm for Title III, although in this case it's an individual consumer who is suing in his own behalf, which is also a way of enforcing Title III. But we've talked about the Department of Justice being on the cusp of issuing regulations in the Obama administration, and then somehow or another that going by the boards with the change in administration. So there's a vacuum there. What can you tell us about the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0, WCAG? Was that an issue in this case?
It was and it wasn't. The guidelines were mentioned as not being just as for what they were, they're guidelines, right? And so those are the globally recognized guidelines that I referred to earlier, where those guidelines are helpful for any businesses that may be listening to this program, for businesses that are interested in this topic and being compliant with ADA. Those are really solid guidelines that are updated with some level of regularity that provide individual businesses with the capacity to have at least an idea of what it is they're getting themselves into. And I think those guidelines are probably the most up-to-date options. Now, Domino's specifically said, you know, they're not required in the United States. It's not something that's law, and so we have no guidelines. And basically what the court came back and said is those guidelines are available to you to be able to use. Now, they're not required, but they're available, so it's not like you didn't have any sort of starting base for understanding exactly how to be compliant with those.
Another issue that, and they make a point of this, that the Title III regulations of the ADA apply to the services of a place of public accommodation, not to services in a place of accommodation. I was interested to see that emphasis on a couple of prepositions there. Can you fill the listeners in on that and what the significance of that is?
Sure. Well, we all know that certain court cases have turned on whether or not there's a comma in certain instances. So it's not surprising that the use of certain prepositions or certain words, I mean, words matter. And I think the difference between the of a place of accommodation and in it is significantly important in this particular case, because if you're a business, right, in the United States, if you're engaged in one of the – there's 12 certain categories that the ADA outlines, and they're available to us, and I could read them off, but that would take up probably far too much time. Essentially, it's places of entertainment, retail stores, restaurants are included in that, which is where this Domino's case came from. Just because your store may be compliant doesn't necessarily mean that, in the Ninth Circuit in particular, it's a physical nexus test. So if you're a store that has physical locations and you also have a website, that means that your website, which gives access to that physical store, also needs to be compliant. And that's the of in distinction, right? Because, you know, if we're talking about Title II, where you're talking about public institutions, you're actually talking about those institutions, specifically museums. In certain instances, they found movie theaters to be public institutions and that sort of thing. With Title III, they take a more expansive approach to the ADA regulation, and the distinction between of and in there is significantly important, particularly when you're dealing with websites. Just because you have a physical store, if your disabled patrons can't get to the store because they can't find your physical location as a result of your non-compliance website, then that's an issue. So I was glad to see that the court really made that distinguishing decision. And the main thing is that they highlighted it really specifically as well. I mean, there's emphasis physically written on the paper, mm-hmm. but the fact that they took, you know, two whole sentences really in the case to explain that decision, I think was really important, particularly for, you know, the listeners of this program, because I think that that's something that you'll continue to see as cases like these continue to expand. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about before we started the show was, you know, what about online only retailers, right? Mm-hmm. What if they don't have a physical store? And right now there's a circuit split. So in the First, Second, and Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, those courts have actually found that a website can be a place of public accommodation independent of whether or not they have a physical store. And those cases in particular were really interesting. I got a chance to read through a few of them yesterday. They didn't really care if you had a physical presence or not. And that is a really expansive approach to ADA from what we've seen in the past. But that being said, the language of ADA specifically says access to goods, services, facilities, and advantages. And I think that advantages word is really unique in the century that we're living in now, because, you know, we're talking about certain stores like Amazon or Etsy, where you tend to find a lot of really fun homemade kind of products, and those sorts of things are online only retailers. Amazon doesn't really have physical stores unless you now count Whole Foods or whatever, but, you know, or the online only grocery stores like Blue Apron or, not to call out online only grocery stores, but there's several services that are being offered now that are online only. So it's actually really nice to see, you know, the certain circuits taking a more expansive approach, because I think it's more in line with the legislative intent of ADA. Even if the ADA hasn't specifically been updated to include websites, DOJ has made it very clear in their opinion letters. Certain court cases have made it very clear that we're going to take a look at websites now. So I think in being consistent with ADA, I think we're going to see more decisions that affect online-only retailers.
Right. The irony, I thought, of Domino's position in this case is, you know, these days everything is online. People don't go to brick and mortar restaurants as much anymore. They want to order out and get it taken to them and consume at their home, and yet think that they were trying to have both sides here. They're trying to apply sort of a sensibility from, you know, my age, the Gutenberg age, where there's brick and mortar places and menus that you pick up and handle and trying to use that to their advantage when they are just playing this modern trend for all it's worth. So and probably making a whole lot of money doing that.
Well, and really, if you think about it too, the decision in this case, in the Ninth Circuit case, actually did rely on that physical nexus. But how fair is it? Let's say, for example, you know, 5-10 years from now, we have an online-only Domino's, right? Let's say Domino's does get rid of all of their stores. Technically, the way that this case is written in the Ninth Circuit wouldn't actually apply anymore, because Domino's has essentially gotten rid of all their brick-and-mortar stores. There's no physical nexus requirement as required by the Ninth Circuit, so it doesn't apply. And so I tend to lean more towards, just me personally, the First, Second, and Seventh Circuit courts, because just out of a fairness principle, right? We all know the law isn't necessarily fair, but out of a fairness principle, it doesn't seem right to require or almost to punish stores that have a physical presence when, you know, probably roughly 70 to 80% of their sales likely occur online nowadays. Mm-hmm. So it's, if you're balancing the weight of the factors here and also thinking of those individuals that actually would really benefit from these website changes, it probably makes more sense to say it doesn't matter if you have a physical presence. It matters whether or not you do business through your website.
Mm-hmm. Early on, you made a really good point that the ADA was enacted back in the 90s. I think the actual law was enacted in 1990, and then it's kind of phased in. A lot of that phasing in went on in the 90s, in the decade of the 90s, and the technology and the sophistication of websites and apps and proliferation of them has been a more recent phenomenon. It's been jet charged, and so there we've got a law that was on the cusp of this trend, and now we're trying to fit it into use with modern ways of doing things, but also with types of businesses that are behind the curve and get, well, for example, one of the cases that they talk about in the Robles case is this United States versus AMC Entertainment. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether you got a chance to read that, but I actually remember when that came down in 2008, and it has to do with movie theaters. Mm-hmm. And what do you have to do to make a movie theater accessible to a visually impaired person? And of course, that case came down differently, I think, than Robles did.
It did, yeah. And the court actually does pick that case up a little bit because, of course, Domino's tries to rely on the AMC case pretty heavily. But the court, I think responsibly so, says that reliance is misplaced. And the reason why is because they were dealing with essentially what was a different issue. In this case specifically, we're talking about whether or not the website was compliant. And in that case, we were talking about the actual physical presence within the store. And so, you know, as a lawyer who's attempting to sort of grasp at straws and pull in cases that deal with this issue, which are relatively limited prior to probably 2015. So, you know, as I can see where Domino's attorneys were probably trying to pull some of this stuff in. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you also have to consider the facts of the cases. And I think that distinguishing factor of the online presence versus the physical in-store presence is massively important in this case.
Right. They didn't use the phrase, I don't think, grandfathering, but there was that concept, I thought, because you're talking about movie theaters that were built maybe prior to the ADA, and mm-hmm. certainly a technology of delivering movies in theaters. They did, I think, use the phrase retrofitting, that it would be an impossible burden or too much of a burden to make businesses like that retrofit to make them totally up to date and accessible to visually impaired people. So it's sure. kind of a grandfathering concept, I guess.
Well, and ADA does recognize that certain changes might be completely cost prohibitive. So for those mom and pop shops around either in the Triangle area or even across the United States that are really worried about, well, you know, do I have to comply with this? This is going to totally kill my budget. I'm going to go bankrupt as a result of this. There is a little bit of leeway, mm-hmm. right, in the sense of if it's completely prohibitive to your business, then the court will at least take that into consideration. Now, whether or not you may still have to comply with it is a totally different, totally fact-specific scenario. So I want to caveat that real quick before I get myself into trouble.
Right.
But there are the courts at least do recognize that there are certain things that would really prohibit. And the AMC case is a really good example of that, right,
mm-hmm.
because you know, updating a movie theater that was built, you know, we have one in Smithfield that was built, what, 1950, something, 1960s?
Before that.
Yeah, I mean, we have one in Smithfield that's been built way long time.
Yeah.
You know, trying
yeah.
to retrofit that thing to be ADA compliant would cost,
right.
you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars at this point. So, you know, there's certain times where leeway is certainly necessary, and the unfortunate side effect of that is that it may not be ADA compliant, which is always a frustrating thing for everybody. But,
right.
you know, the the law can be flexible, and I think that's part of where DOJ is coming from, too, without, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, without releasing specific technical specifications, you know, there is a reason for that. So,
well, one thing, just as we kind of wrap things up here, we want to emphasize that Mr. Robles didn't necessarily win the case. He just won the right to proceed with his case because it was, like I say, the district court dismissed him summarily. Now he's got a right to pursue this and do discovery and put on his evidence and see what happens from there. So this is a case to keep an eye on. So you've talked about some of these other circuits. We're in the Fourth Circuit, of course, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Where do they stand on all these issues?
I wish I had a better answer for you, but as they often do, the Fourth Circuit either hasn't had the opportunity to hear a case, which is certainly probable, but they've remained somewhat silent on it as well. I haven't been able to find any cases that really deal specifically with this issue, but I'll have to keep you posted on that one.
Well, having said that, I think that is a commitment to come back.
Yeah, I'd
love to.
And
be my guest in the future, and we can bring our good listeners up to date on all of this, which is in flux now. And, well, Whitney, we have run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters, and our guest was Whitney Hosey. Thank you so much for joining us, Whitney, and for agreeing to come back in the future, too.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Please be sure to tune in next time on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m. We also rebroadcast the following Wednesday at 7 a.m. We hope you've enjoyed this show and discovered information about your legal rights in ways that will help you obtain equal access and full participation in our community. I'm Joe Austin, your host and producer for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After it's broadcast, you can find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138. You may also reach us via email at info@ncreading.org. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next month, thank you very much.